As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to History Tea Time. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. A History of Breastfeeding and Baby Feeding. Throughout history, women have been feeding their babies from their bodies. Breastfeeding is portrayed as blissful, natural, and easy. But ask almost any mother from ancient Egypt, the Middle Ages, or today, and she'll tell you that is rarely the case. Since ancient times, women have been struggling with when, how, and what to feed their babies, and feeling societal pressure and shame to breastfeed or to hand their infants to a wet nurse or to bottle feed. All the while hearing a great many men's opinions on what they should and shouldn't do with their bodies. Let's take a look at how women throughout history and across cultures have fed their babies. Since the evolution of mammals 178 million years ago, mothers have been feeding their babies milk produced by their own bodies. Humans are the only species to have evolved mammary glands which remain permanently enlarged, even when not lactating. Theories as to why we evolved breasts include giving infants something to more easily grab onto, or to act as fat reserves when food was scarce, like camel's humps. Whatever the reason, breasts advertised a woman's sexual maturity, so men evolved to find breasts attractive. Sexual selection took over, men favored women with larger breasts, and thus the genes for larger and larger breasts were passed down the generations. Anthropologists believe that Neanderthals nursed their offspring until the age of 4 or 5 years, providing vital nutrition when other food was in short supply. Breastfeeding was easier for early human mothers because of their communal living arrangements. There were always other women around to encourage first-time mothers and show them what to do. Breasts became inexorably linked with motherhood in human culture. Numerous deities of fertility are depicted with large and sometimes even multiple breasts. The woman of Wallendorf, a Paleolithic fertility fetish carved some 30,000 years ago, is depicted with large breasts. Around 2000 BCE, ancient Sumerian women believed herbs including anise and fenugreek would increase milk supply. These herbs are popular lactation aids today, though science on their effectiveness is sparse. The Sumerians also believed that beer would increase milk supply, though modern women are advised to keep alcohol consumption low while nursing, as it is passed on to babies. Women in ancient civilizations typically nursed their own babies, but not all women can successfully breastfeed. In cases where the mother died in childbirth but the baby survived, or if the mother was unable to lactate for some medical reason, an alternative was needed. Newborns were sometimes fed animal milk or other substitutes, but this would often result in malnutrition or even death. A better solution, when available, was for another lactating woman, called a wet nurse, to breastfeed the baby. In early civilizations, cross-nursing and wet nursing were typically done by female relatives or other mothers in the community. Lactation is usually stimulated by the hormonal changes which take place after childbirth. So wet nurses typically had a baby of their own. Tandem nursing, or nursing more than one baby at a time, is often the case. A mother's own child may have recently weaned, allowing the mother to carry on nursing a second child. And as mothers often died in childbirth, so too did babies. A mother who lost her own baby might nurse a motherless child. Ancient Babylonian king Hammurabi issued laws formalizing the relationship between a wet nurse and her employers around 1800 BCE. If a wet nurse secretly took a second child to feed and the first one died of malnutrition, then her breasts were to be cut off. According to ancient Egyptian mythology, milk contains magic. The goddess Isis fed her son Horus immortality. In tomb art, Isis is depicted offering her life-giving milk to the dead. Early medical text, the Ebers Papyrus, suggests to get a supply of milk in a woman's breasts for suckling a child, warm the bones of a swordfish in oil and rub her back with it. Or let the woman eat fragrant bread of Sust Dora while rubbing her breasts with a poppy plant. After 6 months of nursing, Egyptian babies would be given cow milk via specially designed nursing flasks. Ancient Egyptian royals and nobles sometimes forced enslaved Hebrew women to wet nurse for their children. According to the Torah, after the baby Moses was found in a basket on the Nile, a palace wet nurse fed him and saved his life. Ancient Hebrews celebrated the weaning of children with a feast to commemorate the feast given to celebrate the weaning of Abraham's son Isaac. In ancient Greek mythology, the trickster god Hermes suckled the infant Hercules at the breast of Hera, the queen of the gods, while she was asleep. Her milk gave the baby godlike strength. When Hera awoke to find a strange infant feeding at her breast, she pushed him away, and her milk, which sprayed across the night sky, became the galaxy Milky Way. Artemis, the goddess of motherhood and the moon, is often depicted with multiple breasts. In ancient Greece, breastfeeding was beginning to be seen as too common for upper-class women, and wet nurses were being employed more frequently. Women could make more money wet nursing a wealthy child than their husbands made as a laborer. The Odyssey contains one of the first written references to wet nurses. Odysseus had a wet nurse named Evryclea. The Greeks believed that a woman's physical, mental, and emotional traits could be passed down through her milk. So it was very important to select a wet nurse who was calm and morally upright. Greeks favored nurses from the warrior society of Sparta. They believed the women would pass on their bravery, athleticism, and strict discipline to their children. Ancient physician Hippocrates observed newborns' sucking reflex and theorized that mothers had nipples inside their uteruses, from which fetuses were fed. Once the baby was born, the milk would travel from the uterus to the breasts via vessels. Hippocrates suggested feeding babies a mixture of water, wine, and honey as an alternative to breast milk. He also believed that if a lactating woman had sex, her milk would spoil. Male philosophers had plenty of opinions on breastfeeding. Plato argued that all children should be removed from their mothers, raised in public nurseries, and fed by wet nurses in order to ensure their obedience to the state. Conversely, Aristotle considered breastfeeding a maternal duty and opposed the growing trend toward wet nurses. He also referred to breastfeeding as a contraceptive method, which is true if not entirely reliable. Plutarch wrote, "It is necessary that mothers breastfeed their own children because they will indulge them with more love and kindness," while a wet nurse was only doing it for the money. According to ancient Roman legend, Vestal Virgin, Princess Rhea, became pregnant by the god Mars. She delivered twin sons, Romulus and Remus, but her brother, King Amulius, ordered his nephews to be murdered. Rhea put her sons in a basket and set them afloat down the Tiber River. They were rescued and nursed by a she-wolf. Romulus would go on to found the city of Rome. Roman physician Soranus of Ephesus thought colostrum, the thick golden milk produced in the first few days after delivery, was of poor quality and indigestible. He advised that newborns be fed mature milk by a wet nurse until their own mother's mature milk came in. We now know that colostrum is ideally suited to jumpstart a newborn's development and immune function, and that nursing from birth is the best way to induce lactation. Soranus also advised a way to test the quality of breast milk by placing it on a fingernail. When the finger is moved, the milk should not be so watery as to run across the surface of the nail. When the finger is turned downward, the milk should not be so thick as to adhere to the nail. As the consistency of milk naturally changes from the beginning to the end of nursing and throughout the day, this was not a very accurate test, but it was used for the next 1,500 years when wet nurses were hired. Wealthy Roman women had a great many social and household responsibilities, which were not conducive to the hours needed to nurse a newborn. Hiring wet nurses was the fashion. Nurses who had delivered a baby boy were favored, as were Greek women, as it was believed that their charges would absorb the Greek language, idolized by the Romans, through their milk. The use of wet nurses was criticized by politicians Cicero and Tacitus, who believed it would undermine the loving bond between mother and child, and therefore undermine the child's love for the Roman state. Islamic scripture, the Quran, speaks of breastfeeding as a continuity from the womb to the outside world, and recommends breastfeeding for 2 years when possible. The Hadith states that a mother receive a reward for every drop of breast milk given to her child. Physician Ibn Sina described breast milk as white blood. The Quran also states that, if you wish to have your child nursed by a substitute, there is no blame upon you as long as you give payment according to what is acceptable. Children who were breastfed by the same woman were considered siblings and were prohibited to marry each other. Ancient Indian scriptures, the Vedas, describe the breasts as pitchers full of nectar with the sweetness of nectarines. Mothers were advised to breastfeed until the eruption of their baby's first teeth, around 6 months. Ancient physician Sashruta recommended that breastfeeding continue until the mother become pregnant again. 10th century Chinese texts on the raising of young children offered breastfeeding guidelines and techniques very similar to what is advised today. Nursing mothers were instructed to eat nutritious foods and avoid alcohol, which is the prevailing advice now. Mothers were also told not to nurse after sex and to avoid negative emotions while nursing, which we now know has no effect on the quality of milk. Breastfeeding was considered below the dignity of Ming Dynasty imperial consorts. Whenever a baby was due in the palace, 40 lactating women were selected for 3-month commissions. They were given medical examinations and an allowance for clothing, rice, and 5 ounces of meat a day. Imperial sons were fed by women who had given birth to daughters, and imperial daughters by women who had sons. This way, the baby's yin and yang could be balanced, and imperial babies could not be swapped or kidnapped. Some imperial children bonded with their wet nurses. Emperor Gao Wei so loved his nurse Lu Lingzhan that when he came to the throne, he elevated her above his own mother. Throughout the Middle Ages in Europe, peasant women fed their own children, while noble and royal women employed wet nurses. Midwives typically delivered the babies of the poor and were able to instruct new mothers on how to breastfeed, while wealthy women were increasingly delivered by male doctors who had only a cursory understanding of female anatomy. Upper-class ladies had a great many responsibilities in running households and getting in and out of layers of fashionable corsets and dresses multiple times a day to breastfeed was completely impractical. A great deal of pressure was placed on women of status to produce as many heirs as possible. So after the delivery of a child, they were expected to return to the marriage bed within a month, especially if they had delivered a girl. exclusive breastfeeding prevents ovulation, and the church preached against sex while breastfeeding. Therefore, most women of status chose to employ wet nurses and hand their babies off shortly after birth, while they focused on their next pregnancy.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered what really happened to Amelia Earhart or the lost colony of Roanoke? Do you ever find yourself scouring the internet for vicious Victorians and their murders by gaslight? Or perhaps you're just sick and tired of women being constantly misrepresented or plain lied about throughout history? If so, join me, Katie Charlwood, history harlot and reader of books, on Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Part of the Airwave Media Network. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Adios, au revoir, au revoir, zen, my friends. Bye-bye. I'll be seeing you.
Queen Anne Boleyn showed her love for her daughter, Elizabeth, by choosing the best nurses to care for her. She kept Elizabeth with her for a short time, often laying next to her on a cushion. But at 3 months, Elizabeth was sent away to be raised at Hatfield House. Anne sent gifts and wrote to Elizabeth's nurse, Lady Bryan, frequently to inquire about her daughter's well-being and give instructions for her care. But her first duty was to try and conceive a son and heir for her husband, King Henry VIII of England. When Anne failed to deliver a bouncing baby boy, Henry had her tried for adultery and beheaded. Despite the social pressure to hand babies off to wet nurses, medieval women still had to endure a heavy dose of shame for it. The Virgin Mary, Queen of Heaven, and the most revered woman in Catholicism, was frequently depicted tranquilly breastfeeding Christ. And the church taught that breastfeeding was a mother's holy duty to her child. Thomas Prior, the 16th century father of pediatrics, wrote a great deal about breastfeeding in his Book of Children. His remedies for increasing milk supply include eating parsnips, fennel root, rice soaked in milk, chicken broth with butter, mint, cinnamon, and mace, and powdered earthworms. Thomas Moffat prescribed breast milk to sick adults. Simon de Valembert suggested a baby should be weaned off the breast at 3 months of age and given cow or goat milk delivered in a cow's horn with a hole pierced in the tip. In 1577, Omniboni Ferrari published the first illustration of a breast pump, which included a long spout reaching up to the mother's mouth to provide suction. Many Renaissance physicians believed that women would impart their character to children through their milk. Redheads were not popular wet nurses, as it was believed babies would take on their fiery personalities. Wet nursing continued to be a lucrative profession with many benefits. Poor women were fed well, paid well, and allowed to live in a comfortable, noble household. Genevieve Potrin was a peasant hired to wet nurse Louis Joseph, son to King Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette of France. Genevieve was given fine clothes and wigs like the other ladies at Versailles. When the Dauphine was weaned around the age of 2, Genevieve retired and was provided a pension of 6,000 livres. Carlos II, the heir to the Spanish Habsburg throne, was so inbred and had so many illnesses that he did not learn to walk until the age of 4 or talk until 8. Until 5, he was fed exclusively breast milk, produced by 14 wet nurses working on rotation. In the Americas, enslaved women were forced to wet nurse for their owners' babies. This could mean the neglect or even death of their own children. In the 18th century, child mortality rates continued to be high. Governments, worried about the decline in the workforce, launched campaigns against the practice of wet nursing. Women were shamed or even forced by law to nurse their own children. English biologist Carl Linnaeus was a strong proponent of forcing women to breastfeed. He also equated breastfeeding mothers to animals and renamed the biological classification Quadrupedia to mammal after the mammary glands. Queen Victoria of the UK had a horror of breastfeeding and said it made her feel like a cow. She hired wet nurses to feed her 9 children. When she learned that her daughters were nursing their own babies, she was furious with them. The Industrial Revolution saw mass migration from the countryside and farming to urban areas and factory work. Mothers had to work to support their families, and factory jobs did not allow the many hours a day needed to breastfeed and care for newborns. Some infants were sent to live with wet nurses. This practice, known as baby farming, was rife with abuse. Some women would take charge of multiple babies for a fee. In many cases, the babies were neglected or even murdered to make way for the nurse to take more infants and more fees. In 1903, Amelia Satch and Annie Walters were hanged for poisoning over a dozen babies as part of a baby farming scheme. Breast milk alternatives were tried, including solutions of animal milk, water, and flour called pap. An early baby bottle was introduced at the Great Exhibition in 1851, which was made of glass with a cork nipple, a spiral air inlet, and ivory pins to regulate flow. Later, a pear-shaped vessel that could be strapped to a mother's chest was introduced. The first dehydrated milk was sold in tins in 1866. By 1900, infant formula made from dry cow milk and other ingredients was widely available and popular. But different brands had different compositions, and there was little consensus in the medical community as to what nutrition babies needed to thrive. As many of these formulas lacked vital vitamins, there was an increase in scurvy and rickets among babies. And infants contracted cholera, dysentery, hepatitis, typhoid, and polio from contaminated water and poorly cleaned bottles. In the 1920s, Guinness Irish Stout ran the Guinness is Good for You advertising campaign, compounding the centuries-old wives' tale that beer would increase the quality and quantity of milk. In the early 1900s, human milk was chemically analyzed for the first time, allowing the development of far superior baby formulas, which provided complete nutrition for newborns. Developed countries also made large investments in sanitation and plumbing infrastructure to ensure clean drinking water. The era saw a steady reduction in infant mortality. Formula feeding became the norm in Western countries. Advertisers convinced parents and doctors that formula was actually healthier for babies because they could add vitamins and nutrients that a mother's body couldn't. These same formulas were marketed in developing countries, where drinking water was still not safe, and breastfeeding had been the norm. As a result, those nations saw devastating increases in infant mortality. Western attitudes towards breastfeeding were primarily negative. It was seen as unhygienic, inconvenient, and only done by uneducated women who could not afford formula. Even if mothers wanted to breastfeed, society discouraged it. Giving birth moved from the home to the hospital. Maternity wards routinely whisked newborns away to be bottle-fed in nurseries. Mothers were instructed to rest and saw their babies only a few minutes a day and not at night. So breastfeeding was rarely established in the crucial first few days. Leading baby guru Dr. Spock advised bottle feeding babies on a regular schedule, but not picking them up or cuddling them, as this would not prepare them to be strong and independent in a harsh world. By 1970, only 22% of U.S. infants were breastfed. Then the pendulum began to swing the other way. In 1956, a group of Catholic mothers founded La Leche League. They saw it as their God-given right and spiritual obligation to breastfeed their children. Their name was inspired by a shrine to the Virgin Mary, Nuestra Señora de la Leche y Buen Parto, meaning Our Lady of Plentiful Milk and Happy Delivery. Their pamphlet, The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding, advises practices which are still used today, including putting babies on the breast within the first hour of life, having baby room with mother after delivery, and providing lactation consultants to show new mothers how to breastfeed. During the women's liberation movement in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, women fought for equal rights, more control over their bodies, access to birth control, natural childbirth, and breastfeeding. Science has increasingly found strong benefits to breastfeeding. Further analysis of colostrum and breast milk have discovered that milk changes and is ideally suited to the needs of a growing infant. And a mother's body is able to provide antibodies to help babies fight off disease and infection. Breastfeeding also provides numerous benefits for a mother's health. In 1991, Medela launched the first direct-to-consumer breast pump, allowing mothers to express milk after returning to work. Dr. William Sears, a proponent of attachment parenting, advocates for breastfeeding and baby wearing into toddlerhood. The World Health Organization and the American Academy of Pediatrics both recommend breastfeeding exclusively for the first 6 months of life. And while many tout the numerous benefits of breastfeeding for the health of mothers and babies and for the economy, policy and employment practices continue to lag behind, putting more burden on mothers. In 2015, 83% of U.S. mothers wanted to breastfeed, but only 14% of U.S. hospitals are breastfeeding friendly. Women in the U.S. are not guaranteed any paid maternity leave, and less than half of employers provide worksite lactation support. The percentage of babies being breastfed falls to 46% at 3 months and 35% at 12 months. Numerous studies comparing breastfed and formula-fed infants have claimed that breast milk ensures everything from better health outcomes to higher IQ. But these studies usually fail to calculate for the socioeconomic differences in the mothers who breastfeed and those who do not. Wealthy, educated white women are far more likely to enjoy the privilege and support needed to successfully breastfeed. In the African American community, there is a stigma against breastfeeding because of enslaved women being forced to wet nurse. Many women also feel uncomfortable or embarrassed about breastfeeding in public or pumping at the workplace. But women who are unable or unwilling to breastfeed can also feel a great deal of pressure and shame. Infant feeding remains a sensitive subject, as it has been throughout history. Parents face difficult decisions in how to feed their newborns. Fortunately, we have far better information and more safe options than there have ever been before. At the end of the day, the most important thing is that parents receive the support they need in however they nourish and nurture their babies. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe. I'll be putting out new episodes every Tuesday, revisiting and revamping my most popular YouTube videos, unburying some of my favorite hidden gems, and adding even more fascinating information for your listening pleasure. Want some visuals with your history? Then check out my YouTube channel, History Tea Time with Lindsay Holiday, where you can find hundreds of videos about queens of the world, royal history, women's history, and more. You can also follow History Tea Time on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other great shows like Queen's Podcast, Ancient History Fangirl, Redacted History, and more.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. From a revolution of hope and liberty to the infamous Reign of Terror, you can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So search for the French Revolution today.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.